welcome to Cairo Nights. Chairman of the board, Shane Peterson, is here, as well as news boss Frank Shires. I'm Mike Lewis. It's a pretty busy show tonight. It always is a pretty busy show. But tonight we talk to Chris Sullivan about a rash of thefts of catalytic converters all over the area. I had mine stolen. This was years ago. But it appears that the thieves have come back. They spent some time in San Francisco, Chris tells us. And then they came up here and hit a bunch of them. We explore the Mariners' postseason chances with Stacy Rust. We small business incubator. There's a small business incubator in Tukwila that you will want to visit as soon as you hear Rachel Bell's story about it. And of course, you know, the random question robot, which never ever leaves us alone. Speaking of random,
yes.
And speaking of questions, let's turn to President Trump. The exchange between the president and a reporter, this happened a day ago, asking if he would ensure a peaceful transition of power. And this is the way that exchange went, if you didn't already hear it.
Right here, Mr. President, real quickly, win, lose, or draw in this election, will you commit here today for a peaceful transferal of power after the election? And there has been rioting in Louisville. There's been rioting in many cities across this country, red and your so-called red and blue states. Will you commit to making sure that there is a peaceful transferal of power after the election?
Well, we're going to have to see what happens. You know that I've been complaining very strongly about the ballots, and the ballots are a disaster.
I understand that, but people are rioting. Do you commit to making sure that there's a peaceful transferal of power?
We want to get rid of the ballots, and you'll have a very peaceful. There won't be a transfer, frankly. There'll be a continuation. The ballots are out of control. You know it. And you know who knows it better than anybody else? The Democrats know it better than anybody else. Go ahead.
Yeah. So the president's refusal to commit to a peaceful transfer of power if he loses drew a swift blowback from both parties in Congress. Lawmakers turned to unprecedented steps to ensure that he can't ignore the vote of the people. Correspondent Wei Zhejing reports.
Several senior Republican lawmakers insisted there would be an orderly transition no matter who wins.
It doesn't matter what the president says. The Constitution says the presidency ends on January 20th.
Mitt Romney, a frequent critic of the president, said the thought of not handing over power was unthinkable and unacceptable, and the behavior of an authoritarian regime.
And then there's this.
History suggests that's not true, according to Mr. Trump's own FBI director, who testified today on Capitol Hill.
Now, we have not seen historically any kind of coordinated national voter fraud effort in a major election, whether it's by mail or otherwise.
On Wednesday, President Trump even cited mail-in ballots as the reason why he may not engage in a peaceful transfer of power.
Well, we're going to have to see what happens. You know that I've been complaining very strongly about the ballots.
Joe Biden said he was not surprised to hear the president's view.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi responded to Trump's comments when asked about a peaceful transition of power and who he really admires.
Now, we do know who he admires. He admires Putin. He admires Kim Jong-un. He admires Erdogan in Turkey. He admires people who are perpetuating their role in government. But I remind him, you are not in North Korea. You are not in Turkey. You are not in Russia, Mr. President. And by the way, you are not in Saudi Arabia. You are in the United States of America. It is a democracy. So why don't you just try for a moment to honor your oath of office to the Constitution of the United States?
So, to be completely honest, I didn't think that the media freakout was entirely warranted. You know, it's as if his unconventional, kind of off-the-cuff, poorly planned defensive reactions to things are new. They're not. But it did get another press panic cycle going, and it got tweets from McConnell, who said it will be a peaceful transition. Without referencing the president, it will be a peaceful transition of power. Additional nonsense from the presidential spokesperson, and enough wailing to make Captain Ahab happy. But to what end? I don't believe that President Trump is planning a coup or a revolution or anything of the sort. He's simply trying to do the same thing he's been trying to do for about 8 months. he wants to call into question the capacity of a fair election to happen within mail-in ballots. Now, as you heard the FBI director say, and you've heard many other officials saying, Republican and Democrat, we've got zero evidence that mail-in ballots are fraudulent. Do some mail-in ballots as well as electronic ballots get miscounted? Very few, but certainly it happens. Certainly it happened with the Gore-Bush election way back when. So I don't think anyone's saying that there isn't the occasional mistake. I think what people are saying is that there has never been evidence of a mistake big enough to swing one direction or another on the vote. And what the president is trying to do is convince these kind of middle of the road wobbler voters to not even show up. He stands a better chance of winning the lower the voter turnout is. That has been, I mean, here's a truism in politics, and I think that both the GOP and the Democrats acknowledge this, that the GOP tends to have much more loyal voters, people who show up much more regularly at the polls. The Democrats have more voters, but much more erratic voters. So they show up every other election, sometimes in lower percentages, sometimes not for several elections. And so to the extent that you can discourage people from showing up, it tends to, this is not true in every district, but tends to, if you talk to Republican strategists and you talk to Democratic strategists, it tends to favor the GOP. If you get a lower voter turnout, tends to favor the Democrats if you get a higher voter turnout. And so that's really what the argument is about. I was surprised, however, and maybe I'm wrong about this, and maybe this is actually much more of a constitutional crisis than I think I'm prepared to believe at this particular point, because the president again today doubled down on the idea that this is going to be an unfair election. Now, he has been slowly ramping up his language. He first said it, I don't know, about 8 months ago, and then he started sort of tapping away at this, and gradually the language has become, without any additional proof being in evidence, the language has become sharper and sharper. And that really is, again, in my mind, not an effort to forecast a coup or forecast a lack of acceptance of results. It's an effort to simply get people to not want to cast their ballots. And so I think that you're seeing the efforts on the other end of the equation. You're seeing remarkable early lines. I think if you're a Republican or a Democrat, vote early. I mean, if you're in any way concerned about your vote not being counted, if you feel like if you send it at the end or an hour or so before the polls close, you're going to be in a bad way if you don't just walk it down or take it down to. And I know that this is easier in an area like this than it is in some places, Ohio being a good example, that to drop off your ballot. But the way to fight the whole dropping off your ballot thing is mail it early. Get it. Decide. A lot of you out there listening right now, I would imagine, have made up your mind on where you're going with this. And so there is really no reason. Research your local elections and get your ballot in as fast as you can. And if you get it in early, then none of this is hopefully going to be an issue. And we'll get a decent count on the initial night of voting, and then we'll get subsequent counts depending on how much votes we get in on that first night, and move it ahead like a relatively calm election. But I think that it really is important for people to this year to not wait until the end, so it gives everyone plenty of chances to process the election. The other story we're talking about right now is King County Sheriff's Office. King County Sheriff's Office handles investigations when it comes to frequently handles investigations when it comes to the Seattle Police Department right now. And you may have seen this video. You may not have. The Seattle Sheriff's Office, according to the Seattle Times, is investigating a police officer who was captured on video walking his bike. So he was pushing his bike along during the protests in Capitol Hill, walking his bike or rolling it over the head of a person lying on the ground protesting during a protest on Capitol Hill Wednesday night. The police accountability office requested a criminal investigation in the incident. The Seattle Police Department's force investigation team identified, quote, potential violations of SPD policy as well as potential criminal conduct in the officer. The OPA director, Andrew Meyerberg, said in an email Thursday morning, SPD said Thursday it is referring the incident to the King County Sheriff's Office, which is why I was talking about the sheriff's office. I got a question for listeners, 98973. No matter how you feel about protesters in Seattle or elsewhere, how smart of a move do you think this is? I mean, how much impulse control is this. I know how frustrated and angry protesters are. I know how frustrated and angry police are. They feel very, you know, the great cops out there feel very much, you know, using the term metaphorically in the crosshairs, because they feel like the cops who are doing the good work are actually getting swept up along what they would refer to as the bad apples. The protesters, I think, feel the same way. The many of the people who are peaceful protesting or protesting peacefully until it feels like it's escalated from the other side, and then it turns into some sort of another dust up in an urban area in Seattle or anywhere in the United States. I know both sides are feeling frustrated, and in the heat of the moment, it's difficult, you know, to hold your lesser self back. We all know that from moments when we've been angry and overstepped what maybe our behavior should have been at that point. But a couple of things. One, do you think you could be in that environment, in a protest environment, particularly when it's getting at that front line where the phalanx of police are meeting a whole bunch of angry protesters? Like, at that moment in that place, do you feel like there are not going to be at least 100 camera phones on full record mode during that period of time, or news crews there also filming that? It seems like if there's any moment where you could remind yourself, hey, I got to keep myself in check because I want to keep my job, and this applies to both sides of this conflict or all sides of this conflict, you would not actually then act out in a way like this. But that wasn't the case. So years ago, I don't know if there are police listening, you may have actually at some point taken this guy's test. I was a police reporter in Modesto, California, and I interviewed a man named Philip Trompeter. Philip Trompeter is the guy credited with creating the modern police officer psych evaluation. This is the test you get before you are a cop. And I think there's instances where they use it after you have been a cop, or maybe when somebody is transferring from a department that doesn't use it into one that does. And I asked him, so what is it that gets a cop fired or suspended or forced off the police force? You think it's going to be something like, I don't know, embezzlement or beating up somebody or you know, stealing from another officer or something along those lines. And he said it's all actually the whole category of offenses come into one narrow category. And he said this is by far and away the thing that gets most police officers in trouble. And he said it is poor impulse control. And the reason is that you know, you have an incident where something like this, where this is a cop, he's probably a frustrated and angry cop. He's listening to protesters scream, you know, awful stuff, maybe chuck stuff at him through the course of the evening. Someone's lying, you know, in a peaceful sort of dead body protest, standard kind of protest behavior all over the United States, all over the world. And he decides to roll his bike over the person's head. You know, in sort of a very casual way, just a moment of disdain. I don't think that the person was injured, but nonetheless, it really is. It's not your best behavior. I think the officer would probably agree wasn't his best behavior. And these are the type of things. And I think it's the impulse control thing. And you know, am I suggesting that we need to hold police to a higher standard than the average citizen? Well, we already do. I mean, that's part of the job. And so in this particular case, it really is a shame. It's a shame that somebody decided to act out in this case, leading to an investigation. We'll see where this investigation goes. King County Sheriff's Office, don't expect anything to happen really quick on this. I suspect that the officer is probably on paid admin leave. That's usually what happens in a situation like this. And let's see where it goes. But this whole idea of impulse control is something I think that all of us can probably think a little bit more about. The Sheriff's Office spokesman said the detective, a detective has been assigned to investigate the officer, but it's not clear how long the review will take. And they did, in fact, later confirm they did not identify the officer, but they said the officer has been placed on paid leave. And then the last bit of news, and you heard Frank mention this earlier, the Pac-12 conference is joining the other four large, powerful conferences in college sports and deciding to play football this fall, defying the risks of the coronavirus pandemic. And they want to salvage a season for fans and shore up the financial health of the schools. These schools are definitely very used to getting what is considerable money from broadcast rights and stadium ticket sales and stadium sundry sales as well during these games. Obviously, the stadium stuff is not going to be part of the income stream, but the Pac-12 network, all of the conferences have their own television networks. That sort of money is actually going to, that's the spigot that they want to turn back on. The Pac-12 said last month that its teams would not compete at least until 2021, but it changed its mind and said it would attempt to play as soon as November 6th. It looks like it's going to be shortly after Halloween. The decision came after the Big Ten, which had also elected not to complete this semester, reversed its approach and announced that games would begin in October. This is from the Seattle Times. Independent medical experts and even some college sports officials have questioned in public and in private the propriety of playing during a pandemic that's, that's really ravaging the country. But the leading conferences, which have imposed testing mandates, if you've talked to anyone who has an athlete, a kid, brother, sister, who is in Division I sports right now, they are really, I think they're doing a lot of work to try and keep the kids safe. I think it's in their best interest to do so. None of the schools want to have an outbreak because I think that from a publicity standpoint would be a nightmare. But they are doing a lot, as much as they can, to keep the kids cocooned. I know at places like, Ohio State, of course, G. Scott, his son, is a football player at Ohio State. I know that they are doing twice a week testing. They're keeping the athletes in their own separate dorms. They're keeping them separate into their workout facilities. It is an environment, I think, where you can keep the big schools anyway. I don't know about the small schools, but the big schools anyway can keep the athletes relatively cloistered because they kind of did already. I mean, those athletes tended to have their own facilities, their own places to live, independent of the rest of the student body. So we'll see. I mean, hopefully they can get through this thing. They can play football in a safe fashion. None of the kids, I don't care about win-loss records. I care about the kids being safe. If they are all managing to play and enjoy themselves out there and not get infected, I'd call that a win for everyone. Coming up, Rachel Bell, stay tuned and listen to this story. You are going to dig it. It is my favorite story of the day by Rachel Bell about a Tukwila business incubator something you won't expect, but you will absolutely hear this story, and immediately you'll probably head there this weekend to check it out right after the break. With the pandemic in place, it's really had a negative effect on the food and beverage industry. But apparently there are actually things that are improving, or maybe even new opportunities that are happening for people here in this area, right?
Yeah, there's been some new restaurants opening, and I'm always very surprised at that. But right. There is one in particular that's been in the works for a couple of years that is very special.
I'm cooking chicken for the empanadas for tomorrow, and onions, garlic. And,
Monica De Bartolomeo, an immigrant from Argentina, has a dream to open a bakery featuring the pastries and sweets from her home country.
The price of the kitchens, when you have to rent a kitchen, is very expensive and too risky, especially when you are starting.
So Monica, along with many other immigrant and refugee women of color, found a home in the incubator program at the Food Innovation Network.
The intent of the incubator program is to help folks that have not had access to commercial kitchens, have challenges navigating the permitting system. The incubator program provides services around business development as well as a commercial kitchen space. Even as English as my first language, I can tell you navigating permitting systems, it can be really confusing.
That's program director Kara Martin. For several years, the incubator program has helped immigrant and refugee women launch catering companies, create food products, and sell their food at farmers markets. But until now, they didn't have a permanent physical space. But now you can visit Spice Bridge in its brand new building, complete with commercial kitchen.
Spice Bridge is a global food hall here in Tukwila. We're a nonprofit running a food business incubator. So when you come in, you're supporting businesses that are just getting launched and have incredible culinary talent.
Spice Bridge features four restaurant kiosks and eight vendors that will rotate through. Some of the cuisine that is served there is not yet represented at any other restaurant anywhere in the region, like Caroline Musitu's Taste of Congo.
I'm making the food that's most popular in my country, Congo.
Caroline fled the Congo in 2009 with her husband and two children.
There is a war. There is no peace. That's why we came here. Yeah.
Her first job in Washington was in the Oberto warehouse in Kent. But thanks to the incubator program and Spice Bridge, you can now taste her cooking.
Mine is like a big, big step. It's my dream.
Oh, that makes me so happy for you. How long have you had this dream?
I think since I was little, I was dreaming of.
Caroline says opening a restaurant has been her dream since she first started helping her mom cook as a little girl in Africa.
That's the bell pepper. I'm cutting for the yassa.
Umi Sala chops bell peppers in the Spice Bridge kitchen for the dishes she'll be serving that day.
Jollof rice, chicken yassa, chicken dibi.
Omi cooks Gambian and Senegalese food with her sister, Adama Jame, for their catering company, Alefa Jollof.
I am from Gambia, West Africa. I came to the United States to better my future and change my life because I was going through a lot in there.
She left Gambia to leave a bad marriage behind.
You know, it's not easy sometimes with our husbands and the families. So that's why I am here.
Umi says she is forever grateful for the Food Innovation Network's help navigating the complicated system and helping her get a business off the ground.
These people are great. Yeah. If we have a word more than thank you, we will give it to them. They make everything possible for us. Till we come here, we were crawling until now, we are walking with our feet. And we are so proud of them. Everything is convenient for us here. So we have a very, very big thank you for them.
But the women also have stake in their success and help each other out as much as they can.
Could I get two of the veggie samosa and then a small cup of the jollof rice, please?
Eight vendors at Spice Bridge means food from more than eight different countries, including Cambodia, Afghanistan, and a Tanzania, Somalia, and Kenya mashup. Here's Monica again.
The thing that I can say is that if you have a dream, just follow it. If you let your cook, just keep doing it. We spend more than 10 years trying to do this. And the day came and the dream came true.
Spice Bridge is open 6 days a week in Tukwila. You can find more about it, the hours, the location at mynorthwest.com/Rachel Bell. It's basically the American dream.
That story was phenomenal. I love it.
Thank you.
And that kind of stuff makes me so, I get so worked up because you think about the people and like the whole notion of the anti-immigrant bias and like you hear this, like this is it. That's right. It. That's the American dream in a nutshell. I cannot get enough of those stories. I love that.
There's also a strange thing that happens with food from abroad because, you know, you saw this with Trump. Everyone loves Mexican food in this country, but a lot of people want to build a wall and they don't connect the two things. And you hear all the time food brings us together. And it's true. But a lot of people can't get beyond the food. You know, I'm sure there are a lot of people who would love the food that these women are cooking, but would still not want them in our country. And there's it just doesn't make sense to me. There's just such a divide.
Well, and also it is a shout out to the incubator itself. I mean, this is what you can do. You can actually create a platform by which people can do their own work and find their own success. And I think that is I think that's marvelous. And I do hope that I mean, I know personally I was thinking of doing a long bicycle ride this weekend and now I've got a destination.
I mean,
that's exactly what I'm going to do because I'm super excited. One, I don't know that I've ever had, the West African, was it Senegal?
There's Senegal, Congo.
Congo, and one other.
Now I don't have my script in front of me, yeah.
And you know, it's an opportunity not only to try something new, but something that I actually firmly believe in. I mean, that's one of the things when people always talk about the downside of what cancel culture or whatever that they like to talk about. The upside is voting with your pocketbook. And and when you see something that you dig and that you want to stay around, and something that's actually managing to take root at the worst possible time for restaurants to try and do that, go down there and spend some money. I mean, this is, you're not going to feel worse for it. You're going to feel better for it. And I know personally, I plan on doing that.
It's the perfect place to put it. I think, you know, Washington is quite white, and so people forget that Tukwila is very diverse. And a few years ago, I'm not sure if this is true, but it was the most diverse school district in the country. So it's definitely still up there. They speak about 60 languages in Tukwila schools. Wow. So having this place there, you know, there's going to be a lot of people who already know this food and eat this food that will be happy to go. But there's so many people like me who are just into trying new things. And I feel bad for them opening right now because, you know, they were supposed to open months ago and they kept putting it off for quarantine and eventually just said, hey, we have to do this. So they don't have, you know, the delivery system set up that a lot of restaurants do. So they rely on people going down in person and getting food to go.
Yeah. Again, you know, this is one of those things that I love to hear about. I love also to hear about a business incubator that actually is dealing with people on the lower end of the income spectrum. I mean, there's a lot of incubators that are sort of about, well, if you can generate $500,000 in venture capital, you know, we're going to help incubate. Like, all right, that's great. I'm fine. And that has its place. But the incubators that really, that's the whole culture, the microloan culture, the whole idea of providing enough for someone just to get started, because getting started is really the difficult thing. And the fact is that we have a whole group of, and it's women, who are getting started in this thing. They all are making, you know, I told you when the thing started, like the worst thing you can do to me is have that deep fryer sound at the beginning of this.
And hear the word chicken.
I got completely distracted and I mean, my stomach started growling immediately. So I love the story and I'm really excited for the fact that, that we have this locally, and everybody in Seattle, sometimes I think don't realize that the real actual cultural diversity happens less in Seattle than it does in the Seattle suburbs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, going down south is a place to get your culture. And, you know, at the beginning of the whole civil rights movement that we're in right now, one of the stories I did involved around, you know, you need to show your kids that you have healthy relationships with people of all colors. And there was the idea of, well, what if you don't have a black friend? What if you don't have friends of different cultures? And the message was, leave your neighborhood, you know, like you
exactly.
move to a neighborhood for a reason, nothing to do with race, but you move there. And sometimes you have to leave it. So if that
Absolutely.
Means, you know, driving a half an hour, 45 minutes to go down to Tukwila to get a meal, it might be worth it so that you can be around people who don't look like you. You can hear accents and different languages, and your kids can too, so that that becomes normal for them. You know, different flavors, different accents. It's super important.
Absolutely. Well, Rachel, thank you very much.
Thank you. And again, go to mynorthwest.com/Rachel Bell for information on how to get there.
Welcome back to the show. You're going to have to make a decision about something. Maybe you won't ever have to make this decision. I think I've already made the decision. It's about home surveillance. I get that people are worried about porch pirates, and I get that they're worried about break-ins in their house. I mean, that's understandable. We've had alarm systems. ADT was popular back in the day. I imagine ADT is probably battling it out a bit with the various Amazon contraptions that you can get from your Ring doorbell or whatnot. Well, if you were paying attention to the tech unveils today, here's the new one. I'm not sure that this is necessarily a great idea, but you can decide for yourself. It's the Ring Always Home Cam. It is a home drone. So if you look at it on the product sheet, and you can find it today, the Ring Always Home Cam. It looks like a small cube. The top section of it rises up, and it is a drone camera that can fly through your house. Amazon unveiled it yesterday. It's $249, and it hums as it flies around the house, filming everything, ostensibly, as the New York Times puts it, for security purposes. This is an unusual step in home surveillance. If you need, I guess the question for you is, do you need a fully autonomous surveillance drone inside your home? 14 months ago, someone had this is a press release from Amazon, wrote up a future press release of a multi-cameras drone that flies from every room in your house, surveilling your abode from overhead. This is actually what, and this was just supposed to be a fanciful idea. This actually now exists for you to buy. So I guess it, if you want to text in 98973, if this appeals to you, I would say that if you're worried about home security, obviously there's things about this. I don't know if the drone flies on an automatic pattern or whether the drone flies is something that you can control remotely. So say you want to take a quick walk into a bedroom or into the garage if it's connected to your house and see what is exactly going on in there. I suppose you will. I think it can fly on a preset pattern and then probably land itself back in its charging station and just do this from time to time. I got to say, though, I would think that if you're worried about such things, maybe a fixed camera is a little better idea if you're worried about that, but maybe not one at all. And here's why. If you remember when the Ring doorbell came out 2 years ago and then got popular, really popular about a year ago, you started seeing a whole bunch of people incorporating it. People really liked the idea that you could see from inside your house who was on your doorstep. And I completely understand that. I don't disagree with that whatsoever. The problem, of course, was that it was relatively low security and was somewhat easily hackable. Initially, Amazon blamed its own customers on the fact that their system was getting hacked because they had used a password that they had used before, which is only true with, I don't know, 98% of people who use passwords. Of course we use the passwords we've used before. Many people do. We all know that it's not the most safe way to go, but we also know it's difficult to remember iterations of 9 different passwords and keep changing them all the time so you can stay secure. Well, this is the problem, again, I think, with the Ring Always Home Cam. Now, who knows? Maybe it has some slightly better security measures put in. That's also not clear at this particular point. But it's one of those products that actually is typified by a lot of the reaction was not necessarily positive when Amazon put this out. This is a longtime tech product reviewer tweeted out, in a country with no laws regulating digital privacy, and that's actually true, no laws regulating digital privacy, anyone who buys this from a company with a history of privacy problems is insane. That was Walt Mossberg, a longtime tech product reviewer who's a member of the nonprofit News Literacy Project Board. The reaction was fairly similar across the board. It was also like that for the Ring doorbell, I have to confess, and the Ring doorbell itself ended up selling relatively well and actually became a favorite of law enforcement, especially when it comes to catching porch pirates, which it actually has been instrumental in helping to do. Anyway, I guess you're going to have to make your decisions for yourself about this. I think right now I am very, very disinclined from adding to the surveillance state by putting a flying drone actually inside my tiny house. Next up, we are going to talk about your gym, the culture of going to gyms, and how people have really had to change what their behavior is, weirdly enough, to behavior that was very similar in the 1950s, which was working out at home. We're going to have a long conversation about whether or not you should be going to the gym, and when you do, what you can do to keep yourself safe right after the break.